All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Welcome, everybody. Holidays are coming. I hope they're tolerable. I hope they work. I hope they give you a reprieve. Who knows, right? Well, I didn't have to end it like that. Happy holidays. That's what I meant to say. Even though they're next week, I'll talk to you before then. But I'm getting in the spirit. How would that be? Does that sound reasonable? Yeah, that's what it is. This is the tone of my holiday spirit. So anyway, folks, I'm in New York. I'm doing a small cameo part in this Bruce Springsteen motion picture, Deliver Me From Nowhere. It's a minor part, but it's an important part. I play a studio engineer. And I think I can talk to you about this. I won't say anything about the film, but it's already public information. Jeremy Allen White is playing Bruce Springsteen. And Jeremy Strong is playing his manager, John Landau. So I've been here at the Power Station in New York, where the actual recording sessions that we're documenting in the movie took place. And I've never been here, and it's a fairly historical studio. A lot of people have recorded here. But, I got here on set. I've got a few lines, but, I'm present in these scenes, and I have sort of these moments with the two Jeremys. And so I'm working with Jeremy Strong and Paul Walter Hauser is here as well, and some other people I know, and Jeremy Allen White. I've talked to Hauser and I've talked to Strong on the podcast, so I feel like I know them a bit. But I've also talked to Bruce Springsteen on the podcast, but he and the actual John Landau are here. They're like here all day. So in between takes, it's really an amazing thing. Okay, there are moments where no matter how much I may whine or complain or get anxious or neurotic about my life, there are moments that I clearly have no choice but to go, holy fuck, this is kind of amazing. I mean, in between takes, I'm like catching up with Bruce, the boss. Obviously he remembers talking to me, but he's just there at Video Village. Scott Cooper's directing, but everyone's kind of sitting around and, it's a long day and there's a lot of motion and people here and there. And I've just taken as many opportunities as possible to be as seemingly casual as I can to engage, Springsteen in conversation, and it's been a real kick. I don't know what life I'm living, but the fact that I have enough background with Bruce Springsteen just from interviewing him a while back, and this happens fairly frequently, I made enough of an impression where he remembers the conversation, and so I can kind of pick up from a place that's familiar, and I'm just kind of hanging around in between takes, talking to Bruce Springsteen about open tunings, about John Mellencamp, about New Jersey, and I don't know what to tell you. It's been an amazing experience for the day I've been here. So today, speaking of acting, I talked to Justin Kurzel. He's the director of The Order, which is out now. And as some of you know, I play Alan Berg, the Denver, Colorado talk radio host that was gunned down by The Order. People have been asking me what it was like to be shot, because it's a pretty brutal bit of business. I'm only in the movie for a few minutes, but I do have some mic time as a radio personality, and then I get out of my car in my driveway and I'm assassinated with the American version of an Uzi. I can't remember what the model of that gun is. I can't remember what it's called, but it was a full-on, I had to put a jacket on with squibs, and we had it wasn't a huge budget movie, but they had enough for two jackets loaded up with the blood explosions. So we really had to nail it. And I think we got it on the second one, thank God. And the blood was all over everything. It's very sticky. It's a sticky mess. It's a disturbing bit of business. But I didn't get to know Justin that well during the shoot because it was one of these parts where I was only there for a few days. But I think it was an impactful few minutes on screen, and I think it sets the movie rolling in a pretty disturbing way. Rightfully so, it's disturbing. But if you watch the movie, you'll find that Kurzel is he's a very nuanced and very kind of a visionary director. And it's weird because I didn't really know it until I started to dig into his catalog. Because I have to talk to the guy, and I, you know, obviously I'd seen The Order, and I like it, and I know that he's got a tone. But then I watched some of his older movies. He did a movie called the Snowtown Murders. It might be just called Snowtown. And then he did another movie called Nitram, which is about a mass killer, the Port Arthur killer in Tasmania. And Snowtown Murders is also a true story about a serial killer who had sort of radicalized a community to enable him to kill, and some of the members of the community were also involved in the killing, specifically of accused sex offenders in the area. And they are amazing movies. I mean, they're poetic, they're dark, he's got a way of shooting, there's a sensibility to how he uses the country of Australia and the landscapes of Australia, and he's just a very gifted filmmaker. And it's just odd, you know, I get these gigs, like Scott Cooper, who I'm working with now, directed some great movies, Black Mass, which I talk about constantly. He's great. And, you know, what, the Pale Blue Eye, and then Hostages, and then that one with Woody Harrelson, of course, Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges years ago. But Kurzel, I wasn't familiar. I knew he had directed movies, but God, they are disturbing, poetic, amazing character studies, those ones. Nitram, Caleb Landry Jones, who that guy in Nitram, which is a sort of character study of a mask shooter, that guy gives a performance like unlike anything else that exists out there. It's just fucking genius, and you can't even begin to understand where it comes from. And Judy Davis is in it, plays his mother, and I haven't seen her in years. And it was just, it's an amazing actor's movie. I mean, just amazing. I completely recommend these Kurzel movies. I mean, they're just stunning. They're just disturbing and so worth watching. Like he also did I believe it's called The True History of the Kelly Gang, about Ned Kelly, the mythic Australian outlaw. And that is unbelievable. Just unique movies that kind of displace the narrative a bit to kind of honor the feeling of the film. And it just, I don't know. I get excited, you know, as I get older all my life, but to get older and then to see things that blow your fucking mind. I mean, that is a gift. So what am I doing exactly? I am recommending that you see these movies. And also watch The Order, okay? That's all I'm doing. I'm plugging stuff that I'm involved with, and I'm plugging people that I like for no other reason other than I like them. So my 2025 tour kicks off in Sacramento, California at the Crest Theater on Friday, January 10th. Then I'm in Napa, California at the Uptown Theater on Saturday, January 11th. Fort Collins, Colorado, Lincoln Center Performance Hall, Friday, January 17th. Boulder, Colorado at the Boulder Theater. On Saturday, January 18th, I'll be in Santa Barbara, California at the Lobero Theater. On Thursday, January 30th, San Luis Obispo, California at the Fremont Center on Friday, January 31st, in Monterey, California at the Golden State Theater on Saturday, February 1st. Then I'm coming to Iowa, Missouri, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Texas, South Carolina, Illinois, Michigan. Yeah. A lot of that's, I guess I should just call it my red state tour. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my dates and links to tickets. What else is happening? I don't know what your Christmas plans are, but I'm going to go see my dad. I feel like that any opportunity I can, I should go out and see my dad in these days and months, hopefully years. I don't know where he still remembers me. I know a lot of people have been through this. It's obviously new to me. It's hard. It's somehow a little existentially scary, as this unfolds. It's one thing, I guess, if your parent dies and at least there's a certain amount of closure, and obviously that will happen. But to see them drift away and still be alive and be vacant in terms of their memories of their life, their memories of the life you had with them, it's rough and weird and highly common, obviously. I am trying to spend as much time as possible. And this is a man that I've had problems with on and off over my life, but I love him. My mother's around too, but she doesn't have dementia and she's in Florida, but I got to go see her too. And I'll try to make time for that in the new year, but it's not as pressing because she still knows me. And I don't know if that's a way to prioritize spending time with your elderly parents, but I guess I'm choosing to spend time with the one whose memories are drifting away as opposed to the one who seems to have a pretty good recollection of everything. And hopefully that won't change and I'll get to spend time with her as well. Okay, well, I guess that's my holiday pitch. Spend time with your parents. They're not going to be around forever. And they may not be around even if they are around. So look, I had this conversation with Justin Kurzel, the director I was talking about earlier. The Order is playing in theaters now. And like I said, I would highly recommend almost all of his other movies. There's only two I didn't see. I didn't see Assassin's Creed or his Macbeth, but I believe I've seen all the other ones. And The Order is disturbing, and the other ones are too. So brace yourselves and know that you're going to deal with some heavy shit, but it's all done brilliantly on a cinematic level. And he came into my house, and I hadn't seen him since we shot the movie. And so this is me talking to Justin Kurzel. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah,
How's, what is the, as I was about to say off the mic there, though, the part that I did in your movie, in The Order, was a small but essential part.
It was.
I didn't know I would, like, open the movie. But I guess it's the right way to go.
Well, the character played in many different parts. It was sort of it opened the movie,
yeah.
and then it sort of played continuously sort of through the movie, and then it ended the movie.
We
actually sort of went back to it, so it was quite a malleable character.
Well, I gave you enough stuff. You were standing over me, keep going. Remember?
I remember.
Yeah, on the mic, just keep going. And I realized, like, oh, he's got to fill a lot of radio time.
Well, I thought it'd be kind of really amazing to have. To have your voice as a sort of narration,
yeah,
all the way through, you know, in quite an unconventional way. But you were really important to it. I was actually most nervous about you saying yes.
Really?
This. Yeah, I didn't see anyone else in the role.
Well,
I really
didn't. How did you hear about me?
Well, I remember being in London and I was doing a film and I was sort of hating it.
Yeah.
And my family
was
away
from
me. It was this film called Assassin's Creed.
You hated that movie?
I hated the process of making it because we didn't have a script and it was just really challenging and really kind of hard. And my family were away from me. It wasn't that I hated doing the film. It was I sort of hated the time because I was feeling quite lonely.
It was such an out-of-character movie. Was it a job?
No, it was. I just got really seduced by the concept and the idea of the game, which was this sort of idea of sort of, you know, the DNA sort of traveling through us and the idea of sort of who are we and what are we from our ancestors. And Michael Fassbender and I had worked on Macbeth together.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kind
of. So you guys were tight. You had a rhythm.
Yeah, we had sort of something there. But yeah. I remember walking around Hyde Park and started listening to your podcast.
Oh, really?
Like, this is really early on in that that fantastic one you did with Louis.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was just kind of amazing that you were trying to work your shit out through talking on a podcast, and I found it just captivating.
Yeah.
So I'd listened to you a lot.
Yeah.
And there was, just as soon as I read the script, I kind of just thought about you.
Well, that's funny, because when they offered the role to me, they said he wants you to play Alan Berg, and I thought, well, who else is going to play Alan Berg?
Was Alan Berg someone that was a figure that you were very conscious about?
Yes, I mean, I absolutely knew who he was. I knew the story. I had, at some point in my life, kind of looked into it and who he, you know, like what happened without. I think it was pre-internet rabbit hole, but certainly I saw Bogosian's show and then the movie. And I think that probably when that came out, it elevated my fascination with Berg. But I knew of him, but I didn't know specifics. And it turns out, even with the research that you did, there's not a lot there to go on. There's a bit of audio, and then there's just the, you know, who he is. So, but I was always sort of fascinated with the idea of it, you know, just a solitary voice that, you know, lodges in this this ideological kind of, you know, that becoming a target. And I thought, well, if I do this, maybe it won't happen in real life. Like, I feel, you know, I feel threatened. I feel scared in general. Yeah, I don't know how much of it's paranoia and how much of it's real. You know, obviously I'm not high on the target list as a guy who speaks his mind, but certainly when I go out into the world to do stand-up, I feel it. So I just thought that I had to do it. I thought it was some sort of serendipitous thing, beyond coincidence.
There's something interesting you said the other day in that press conference, that you kind of, you know, you do your thing and you put it out there, and sometimes you don't know where it lands.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no. And now with, you know, everybody's so accessible one way or the other. If somebody wants to get to you, it's pretty easy. And I think, you know, in light of your movie and then in light of however they're framing or whatever this assassination of this healthcare CEO is, that, you know, that was a political assassination. It was a premeditated, meant to have an impact. And, you know, there's many people think he's a folk hero or somebody who did something that finally needed to be done to raise awareness or something. But once, you know, people start taking these guns into their own hands for specific reasons, and you've covered both types of people in terms of your films, where you've got people who take up arms for psychological problems. And I guess ideology can be a psychological problem, but there is sort of an agenda to that. And then you've dealt with just guys who kill people. So, like, I don't know that you would have thought your movie, The Order, would necessarily be seen as a hero's journey.
Well, it definitely sharpened up as we were sort of writing it and then shooting it and then editing it's come out in release, and since then we've obviously had the election, so it's certainly sharpened up.
Well, I mean, what kind of, are you seeing any of that type of reaction to it, that that the intention of your portrayal of this guy was not meant to elevate him with that community, which is large now?
Well, I you know, when I read it, the screenplay, and then the book, The Silent Brotherhood, it was very stealth-like, all this stuff. I mean, it was really sort of sitting in the shadows. And I think even at the time when those kind of heists were happening and they were sort of building this militia for these domestic terrorist attacks, it was all pretty unknown.
Well, yeah, this was like supposedly the minority, the margins, the dark underbelly of what we always knew.
Yeah.
But there's an order in every small city. I
think that's what it is. Is it so? I mean, there's a discussion in the film where Butler, the head of the Aryan Nation, talks to
the old
Matthews.
Guy.
Yeah, talks to Bob Matthews about just steadying down. you know, and he sort of says, you know, in 10 years' time, we'll have people in churches and high places, yeah. And it is kind of – that to me is what's quite shocking, is just how kind of visible it is now. And
well, they were very stealth, you know, and the sort of marriage of, you know, religious activism and, you know, conservative politics, whatever that may be, that the right was, you know, slow and steady. It's not – it didn't happen overnight. You know, the way it's all come together, you know, and now with this sort of influx of young men's grievance and the brain-fucking ability of technology to radicalize fairly quickly, you know, it's just a perfect storm. And I don't know what the fuck it's going to look like. You get to go back to Australia.
I do. I saw a fantastic photo the other day sent by Kevin, who wrote The Silent Brotherhood, sitting in a cinema with Alan's ex-partner, who was watching it for the first time.
His ex-wife?
Yeah. She was extremely moved by the film, and obviously, you know, very confronted by the assassination scene in the film, but felt, you know, really, really heartened by it, which was lovely to
hear. Did she say, "I did all right with Alan"?
Yes.
She did?
I think so. Yeah. No, I think there was a simpatico with you and that character. There was just something there that was just sort of effortless. I mean, that was what was really interesting about directing you.
Yeah.
Your experience and the DNA of you next to this sort of presenter, and how much is you and how much is the character and how much to kind of push certain things. That was really interesting
working for you.
Yeah, it was, because you know your voice is so recognizable, and then there's such a kind of thing there, and then Alan has his own voice, and it's kind of like, okay, do I push you towards this other character, or do I embrace naturally what's sort of coming from you? It was an interesting little tussle.
I think that, you know, ideologically, and you know, in terms of our impulse to start shit for the right reasons, you know, I think I shared that with him, because this is not a guy that was – this was pre-talk radio, really, you know, in terms of the cultural impact of what talk radio become, primarily on the right. And this guy was just, you know, a sort of righteous shit starter, because none of the stuff that was in the script or even in his audios was not necessarily political. It was anti-racist. And it was provocative, but I understood where he was going, because I have that same DNA. So what I did try to do, and I noticed when I watched a movie, that I did get it a couple times. He did have a slight Midwest thing going. And I did kind of do that prep work, and I didn't know if it would come out, but it did a little bit. And that's all he had, a little bit of Chicago in there.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yeah.
And I was just happy that we were able to sort of get the look, because it was so jarring, the way he looked, because he had that head injury that he was trying to cover all the time with that hair. And I had the beard, so it wasn't really a big stretch to make it work. I was thrilled by the whole thing. I watched it and I was like, I felt good about it.
Yeah. I think also that speech that you make in it too, that we sort of talked about in terms of everyone treating each other nicely.
Yeah.
You know, that landed really strongly.
Just before the assassination.
When you sort of talk about everyone just listening to each other and loving each other. I mean, it's interesting that kind of went back and forth in terms of where it wanted to be.
Yeah.
That was you. I mean, that was your that was just you coloring something there that went beyond, I think, the kind of rants and the kind of familiarity of some of his sort of programs.
Yeah.
There was something in there that suddenly felt very personal and point of view, and it was really beautiful.
And it spoke to the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So, you know, we had the leeway to do that.
Yeah.
But like, I've done sort of a half deep dive into some of the other work of yours, and this script, I mean, you know, I watched Nitram, and I watched Murders.
Snowtown
Murders. And you know, there, this script was really, you know, beat-to-beat narrative storytelling. Whereas, like, it seems that, you know, maybe outside of Shakespeare, you're used to working with a little more space.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're not, there's almost no expository writing in either of those movies, which are about murderers. Mm. And so approaching this thing outside of tone, you know, was it challenging or limiting?
No, I loved being in a genre. Like, yeah. I just loved seeing the next pontoon coming in terms of an event, a beat.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was what was unique about the screenplay, that it was very character-driven and that there was it was about sort of something.
It's a procedural.
It's a procedural.
Yeah.
But it had an extraordinary sort of momentum to it.
Yes.
That did remind me of, you know, some of the films that I love the most, The French Connection and,
yeah,
you know, some of those Lumet kind of Friedkin films,
yeah,
Mississippi Burning by Alan Parker.
Right.
Like just those really immersive and thrilling kind of, you know, very classic kind of storytelling kind of genres. So
yeah,
that was something different. Whereas those other films that you sort of mentioned, they do have space and they're character studies.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
And very different kind of tone. But this one was like, yeah, I just want to do, you know, I just want to put my hat in the ring with a good old American film.
And yeah,
there was something about this that suddenly, you know, started to sort of speak in a way to today that was unexpected for me.
What was the arc of you getting hold of this movie? Well, the weird thing is that the main guy that Nicholas Hoult plays, you know, he's not an unusual character for you to explore, you know, other than he had a purpose.
Hmm.
Well, I guess the guy in Snowtown had a purpose, and it wasn't that dissimilar.
Hmm.
He was not part of a movement, but he was a moral arbiter, or saw himself as somebody who was acting in a moral way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by those characters that come into communities and straight away actually almost don't talk. They just sit there and listen.
Yeah. You know?
They just sort of sit there and empower and listen you know, really create a barbecue for people to kind of stand around and think, I belong to something. And
vulnerable people.
Yeah.
Lost people.
Yeah. Outliers and
traumatized people.
Yeah. And those that sort of desperately want family, you know, desperately want. And that was what was fascinating about Snowtown. I mean, it really was like a Western. A guy comes in to a community that's being terrorized by a group of pedophiles where no one's doing anything about it. And he comes in and he solves the problem. And then you know, within the first 10, 15 minutes, you're going, oh, all right, so he's the good guy. And the good guy just happens to be, you know, a serial killer.
Oh, yeah, bad guy.
Yeah. And it always fascinated me that, like, how someone can come in. And that John Bunting character in Snowtown was very unusual serial killer. He was social. He wasn't a hermit. People knew him. He was very visible. So
the real guy.
Yeah, the real guy. And I thought, you know, with Bob Matthews, there was something very reaching about that character. You know, he was, you know, he didn't smoke. He didn't drink alcohol. He was incredibly fit. They had an energy about him that was, you know, obviously engaging, but there was a very strong sense of sort of, yeah, leadership in a way and
purpose.
Your purpose and a feeling of this is my community, this is my family, and we'll build from here.
Well, the interesting thing about, like, Snowtown is that the way you characterize it, that this was a town being terrorized by pedophiles, was it any – I don't have a sense of the scope of the town necessarily. What was it in your mind – were there more pedophiles than any usual city?
Yeah, there were in this particular kind of part of the area, and also people within authority. There was a sort of corruption that was sort of happening there as well.
Yeah.
No one was sort of listening to this particular community. It was very disenfranchised. I actually grew up very close to the area, which is why I became involved in it.
How old were you when the murders happened?
I would have been sort of late teens.
So
but then there were other serial killings that had happened in Adelaide even before that. When and one quite famous sort of group called The Family Murders that happened when I was very young, sort of 12, 13. So I was always, there was always sort of something out there where I was living, or the possibility of being taken, like off the street, was something that always sort of haunted us. But
really,
yeah, yeah, it was. It had a very very strange vibe, and this particular group, these particular murders, so much of it was about this sort of disenfranchised community and about how easy it was for John to kind of exploit these kids and exploit this family. It was interesting speaking to some of the relatives of the family, sort of saying, you know, their life actually kind of changed when John was arrested, you know, because some of these people involved were kids at the time. And after that, they were put into sort of foster homes and, you know, terrible things sort of happened to them. Yeah. So it, you know, I guess I've been fascinated by this sort of feeling of the exploitation of a community and what are people looking for in terms of that sense of security.
And you think that started around those murders or around your childhood?
Yeah, yeah. I was you know, always surrounded by also men, like really interesting kind of role models. We had some really you know, very powerful kind of role models that were around the community that were mostly men and you know, quite positive. But, you know, you also knew there was some bad stuff about them. So it
sure.
was, you know, really, really interesting time. But
was it desolate? I mean, like, because I get the sense even in Nitram, you know, that town, you know, it seemed kind of broken and spread out a bit. Like I didn't get a sense of place other than there was sort of a certain amount of poverty and a, you know, lower class desperation, but not so much in Nitram. But I still didn't, like when he goes to buy the gun in that movie, you know, like that guy, that's a good example. He seemed like a good guy.
Yeah, well, Nitram and Snowtown were two very, very different places in Australia.
Yeah.
Snowtown was in South Australia, and it was in quite a desolate area.
Yeah.
A lot of sort of trust homes, very economically poor.
Was that what the projects, the trust homes?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, a really interesting area, Elizabeth, where it was filmed. A lot of English migrants, and actually. AC/DC came out of that particular
really?
Kind of yeah area and Cold Chisel and a lot of really interesting kind of music because you had a lot of people come from Liverpool and so forth. So it was a very
they came from Scotland, right?
Yeah, yeah.
AC/DC's folks.
Yeah, but it was sort of Scotland, England, and
where'd
and
your
Ireland.
Folks come from?
Poland.
Yeah. They immigrated there.
Yeah, yeah.
For what reason?
Was after the war.
You know, so, oh, okay.
Everyone was leaving. Everyone
so
was
everything
leaving
was
Europe.
Blown up.
Yeah. So a lot of immigrants went there to kind of build the highways and build the you know the water pipes that went from the Murray River into the city. So
what did your dad do?
He worked on the highways.
Yeah.
And he was a taxi driver and he was also a meat inspector. He was working class and he kind of looked after, you know, didn't go to school and looked after the other six kids in the family. And,
you got six brothers and sisters?
Yeah, he had a lot of family that he was looking after. And
your mom was there too?
No, mum was in the Barossa Valley. Those two sort of met up obviously later on, but... Yeah, so it was a really unusual place, really interesting groups of sort of people, but it's very, very poor. And then sort of over time it became, you know, a very disadvantaged kind of place. Whereas Nitram, that is set in Tasmania, where actually I live now on an island down the bottom of Australia. And it was sort of based on the Port Arthur murders, one of the biggest mass shootings that Australia ever had in 1996 in Tasmania.
Yeah.
So it quite different place and quite different area.
Class-wise?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tasmania is sort of like
Tasmania is actually really beautiful and, you know, extremely has an extraordinary kind of history. A lot of Australia's first convicts went to Tasmania in terms of penal colonies and so forth. And parts of Hobart are like kind of Scotland. It's very cultured and very beautiful. So quite different kind of stories and different kind of areas.
But that's not where you grew up.
I grew up near Elizabeth,
Snowtown.
Near Snowtown, yeah.
And how do you get out? I mean, it sounds like your parents were not he was middle class guy, working class anyways. But things were taken care of, right? Yeah. You guys did all right.
Yeah.
You made it by. You had love in the house and whatnot.
Yeah. No, we had a very loving family. We were very sport orientated. And I think my brother and I, who does the music in the films, composer.
All the movies?
Yeah.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah. Jed and I.
Interesting.
Jed and I sort of lived, had a lot of space, and we kind of, we did a lot of sport, and our goals were to become, to win Wimbledon. Like, we wanted to be
tennis
players. Yeah. Yeah.
But the art must have been bubbling up if he's playing guitar. And when do you start to really, come upon the vision to be involved with film?
Look, I think it was my father taking me to see Rocky for the first time, 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. And then VHS started to happen. Video stores really started to go. I remember getting the first Beta kind of video recorder, and that was it.
Oh,
I mean, it was like, eight a week going through them and sort of building them up that way.
Yeah. It just seems like there's a darkness to Australia that I didn't register, but I have been there a few times, but some of the movies that have come out of there's a sort of menace to some of the filmmakers. I don't know who made Chopper, but that's that guy.
Yeah. Andrew Dominik made Chopper, amazing filmmaker.
Then the guy who made The Stranger.
Yep.
What's that guy's name?
Yep. Tom, he's really interesting new Australian filmmaker. There's a
animal. What's the animal one?
Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, who's
David
that guy?
Misha.
Jeez, man.
Yeah, no, there's a really Jennifer Kent who made The Babadook. It can be quite a dark place, Australia. It's there's a history there that's dark and.
All different kinds, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in its origin.
Yeah.
Where the people came from, the first wave was they were convicts, right?
Yeah. Well, in Tasmania, many parts of Australia, there was a sort of genocide,
of the Aboriginal people.
To the Indigenous in Australia. Yeah. So there's a lot of history that, still needs to be sort of faced.
So it's haunted a bit.
Yeah. It's just got something about it that always sort of sits there. And I think a lot of really interesting filmmakers have sort of delved into that. Ted Kotcheff, who made First Blood, Canadian filmmaker, made a very, very famous film in Australia called Wake in Fright.
Yeah.
That was sort of a terrifying film that made an imprint on a lot of Australian directors.
And then there's that older generation. Is it Peter Weir's from there, right?
Peter Weir.
Yeah.
Gallipoli was one of the most, incredible. I mean, it's my favorite film.
Is it?
Yeah. It was very impactful.
Isn't Breaker Morant an Australian
Breaker
movie?
Morant, yeah. Bruce Beresford.
Yeah.
There was that sort of new wave around that time of Fred Skepsi and Bruce Beresford.
Who did Walkabout?
Walkabout is Nicholas Rogue.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was he Australian? He's British, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But Walkabout's an Australian movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing film. It's a really strong history, but there is this sort of underbelly there that I think filmmakers are fascinated by.
And also there's this underbelly too, like in watching Snowtown, that one scene when the two of them are in the hole, smoking weed, and he's like, it's going to be a bomb shelter. And the other guy's like, who's going to bomb us? That there is a sense down there when I was there that there is, it's almost like there's a little bit, it's Irish too, where it's just sort of like, it's its own place. It's out of the fray of global politics. And there's sort of a kind of like literally a sort of a down under type of personality where it's just sort of like, we're fucking Australia. No one's going to fuck with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, no one cares.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a kind of, even the violence kind of comes out of the most unexpected ways there.
Yeah.
And usually it's to do with sort of humor. I mean, I remember when I was doing Snowtown, we were talking to a guy that knew knew the serial killer in it at a pub. And we were having a beer, and No, he was really interesting and he was funny.
Yeah.
We got to the end of the night. We'd had three beers and I said, oh, I'm going now. And he said, no, let's get another one. And I went, no, I'm going. And
yeah.
He said, just one more. And I said, no, excuse me, I've really got to go. And he says, I tell you what you're going to fucking do. You're going to go to the bar and you're going to buy me a beer and you're going to buy yourself a beer and you're going to come back and you're going to sit down and you're going to drink that beer. And I went, okay. So I went over. Went and bought a couple of beers and came back and sat down and he sort of looked at me and stared at me and he said, yeah, anyway, I was telling you that story about, and it's sort of like, it is this, it's sort of Chopper's like that. There are elements, I think Andrew just really got in Chopper about how you just can't underestimate the turns, the shifts, and they're very, very quick.
And the personality.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's menacing, man. I don't know. When I was watching, like, Nitram, I don't know if I could take it.
yeah, right.
And I was like, is this Australian? Because I don't know the sort of pace. And it seemed like pretty early on, you had sort of figured out your tone. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I did. I sort of knew what I was interested in and where to put the camera and what.
Yeah.
You know, there was a feel
that
I was fascinated by and still am. When I go back to Australia and have an urge to make a film there's definitely a kind of feeling that I...
Can you identify it? Because it's like there's a space to it, but it's kind of... there's a menace to it.
There's something to do with the domestic. There's something to do with family. There's something to do with that menace sort of just hiding behind, the front door.
Yeah.
Or actually even the front door open and the menace kind of happening, but just down the corridor. There's a sort of quality to it. I think there's also a very strange relationship that we have with landscape. I think that
there's so much of it.
Well, it is, and you're sort of in awe of it, and you're driving in it, and then suddenly you go left, and you think, actually, maybe I should have gone right.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly sort of stuck, and you look around, and it's terrifying.
Really?
It's just terrifying.
Even with nothing there?
Yeah, it's just terrifying. There's something about it that is equally beautiful and majestic and extraordinary, and there's also sort of something terrifying about it.
But it's kind of nebulous, the terrifying.
Yeah, and it's intimidating. I think the scale of it and the unknownness of it. You know,
do you use the same DP?
I've used Adam Akapor quite a bit. He did Snowtown. Who also shot The Order.
Yeah, that's okay. So I could see that.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So there was I use a couple others. Jermaine McMicking did Nitram, but I usually try to work with the same people. Yeah.
So, what was your first? I mean, Snowtown was the first feature, right?
Yep.
And the shorts. What were the shorts?
I got into music clips. My brother started a band called The Mess Hall, which I was actually part of. I was playing the bass and then kind of got bored with the bass, didn't feel as though it was interesting enough.
Yeah.
And sort of said to Jed, oh, look, I think I'm going to leave. And he said, well, that's fine. We're thinking of becoming a two-piece anyway. And they became a really fantastic two-piece in Australia and, started to get some success and tour and I started doing music clips for them.
Okay.
So I got into it through music clips and then I did a couple kind of little short films.
What were they? Were they like dark?
Yeah, they were that. I was definitely leaning into what would become the features. Yeah.
Dude, I mean, in fucking Snowtown, which just out of nowhere, he walks out back and the guy's just hacking up a kangaroo. Like, as somebody who doesn't live there, I'm like, what are they doing? What is he doing?
Yeah.
He's just killing a kangaroo? And then I thought, like, is it for meat? And then it just turns out to be for nothing, just to terrorize the guy across the street.
Well, just get rid of the pedophile across the road.
Right, with kangaroo heads.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
legs.
But he didn't kill him. He didn't kill the kangaroo in the scene. It was
nobody
was
hacking him up. Was I wrong to assume that? You're telling me he just found two dead kangaroos on the road?
You know, like it's interesting. I live in Tasmania at the moment, and there is roadkill every
few miles?
Every few miles. Like, I mean, it's... They're sort of you're always surrounded by death in Australia. it's sort of something that's
animal death mostly.
Yeah, there's so many animals and
there's a lot of kangaroos. I guess
a lot of kangaroos, a lot of wallabies, a lot of different animals.
Were they wallabies or kangaroos in the
kangaroos? Yeah.
And did you find them dead?
No, we bought them. They were already dead. Yeah. Because look, people eat kangaroo meat. It's actually a fantastic meat. Really, very, very lean. Imagine it's like
do they farm like them?
No, there's so many around that.
Really?
Yeah, and you know they get to certain numbers, especially when the droughts happen when they come in and they start eating the crops. Yeah, so you've got to, you know, you to a certain extent, you've got to cull them.
Yeah. And what do you think? Like, you know, in all the movies that I mentioned, because like for me, because you know, I guess I'm in kind of engaged with psychological language. Like in Snowtown, like they're. You know, you're watching clearly traumatized people, like broken people that are legacy trauma. But I would assume that in shooting this or in engaging with these characters, that's not how you approach them. You approach them as who they are, and this is their behavior. I mean, as a director who, you know, kind of deals in this type of psychological investigation, you know, do you judge them?
I just try to find what feels familiar, like as a character and as a sort of human. I mean, it was interesting. So Daniel, who played John Bunting in Snowtown, he was a Sydney actor who was coming, and I wanted him to sort of live in the area for a good sort of 6 weeks before we shot. Yeah. Because the rest of the people in Snowtown are like people that we just cast off the streets. They're non-actors. So, you know, I was going to the shopping centre.
So they probably knew the guy.
Some did. Yeah. And actually we would have, auditions and people would line up at the gym. And I remember one particular guy saying, "Oh, does John know you're doing this? I was just in prison with him a couple of weeks ago." So it was not many degrees separation. But Daniel, who was playing John Bunting, I said, "You've got to be in this neighborhood for six weeks and you've got to get out there." And I gave him a certain number of things to kind of do. Yeah. But he just sat in his room reading books about serial killers and putting post-it notes up everywhere and wouldn't go out. And, you know, that was, you know, we had a very big discussion about this guy, like you've got to get past the kind of cliche of the serial killer. What is interesting about this person is that they're social. And actually, the FBI came to Australia and came to South Australia and studied this particular character because he was very unusual in terms of how social he was as a psychopath, as a serial killer. So as soon as I spoke to Daniel about you've got to take these kids camping that are in the film, you've got to kind of cook for everyone, he turned up on set after doing all these sort of little kind of tasks, and straight away everyone just sort of came up to him and gravitated towards him. The kids were jumping over him, and there was sometimes it's as simple as that. It's about how do you make this person feel human,
right?
You know, and how do the people around that character sort of see them as human and see them as sort of almost quite normal?
Sure.
And that's when it becomes interesting. That's where you're sort of rubbing up against the largeness of their actions next to the kind of, wow, they don't feel too distant from.
Right. And also, but I thought what was fascinating about that movie and in all the movies really is that even once the people around them get a sense that they're off in perhaps, an uncontrollable and murderous way, they make exceptions. Mm. They rationalize or they see them how they're going to see them. Mm. That happens in The Order a bit, but there's an ideology there. But it happened in Nitram with his parents and with Helen, and it happened in Snowtown with the mother who knew better. I mean, right away, you know, her instincts are solid because of the guy across the street, but yet she still accepts this guy with that intuition, you know, knowing that, you know, he's bad fucking news.
Mm. Well, the evil was like a slow boil. You don't realize that it's kind of cooking.
Yeah.
And I think there is a sort of there's a moment where it's almost too late.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I find so compelling about those characters.
And then what makes you go to Macbeth after that? I mean, are you a Shakespeare guy?
Well, I first started off in theatre. I was a theatre designer, and So I spent a lot of time in theatre and in rehearsal rooms, and I actually designed it when I was sort of just out of school.
Yeah.
So it was out of the blue. I'd seen Michael in a couple of films that I really loved, and the idea of Michael kind of playing Macbeth, and there was something about the way it had been written was like a Western.
Yeah.
You know, and we're shooting in Scotland and in those areas that were sort of set and written, where you look out and you go, there are witches here.
Sure. Yeah.
It's that landscape is sort of saying so much with the verse. So, and there was something also about this sort of post-trauma of a soldier and being able to put on screen this sense of battle and how that carries on into a kind of psychosis and the death of this child and how perhaps grief could turn into ambition. There were a whole lot of little things there, but essentially it was just that, oh, wow, I can totally see this as a Western and I get to shoot in Scotland and there's something, there was also sort of something about the idea of being consumed by evil and what that is and do you become the thing that you kind of, you know,
reach for. It's almost like Shakespeare gave you a map to explore the type of male character you were already interested in.
Yeah. Strangely, on the set, I didn't think it was a huge leap from what was happening in Snowtown, to be honest. It was just a completely different genre.
Right. But I guess that's why, you know, I have a hard time with Shakespeare, but I think that, you know, the people that really get something out of it are the people that realize the, you know, humanity, the full spectrum of humanity available in almost every one of the plays, right?
Yeah.
So Macbeth was definitely a character, you know, up your alley.
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't too far away from what I was interested in.
And you thought of it as a Western. Are you a Western guy? Are those the movies that have the most impact on
you? Yeah. They were very strong in my childhood.
Like which ones?
Well, I'll tell you what, the Western that I loved the most was Mad Max. Like that was—
For sure.
That was the one that I think for most Australians kind of captured my imagination.
But is that a common thing to frame it as a Western?
Mad Max?
Yeah.
No, it would, I mean, it doesn't have horses in it, but it's got some—
But no, structurally, you know, the guy coming to—
Oh, totally.
Yeah, I get it.
Totally. I mean, I would even say Snowtown, the way John rides in on a motorbike into that town.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's sort of Western traits to it. I mean, even the order.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, you know, Jude driving his car into that place.
But those are, you know, motifs. Those are the designators of Westerns.
Yeah, you don't have to do much with them to make an audience go, I feel this and I understand it.
Sure.
You start to invert it and you start to kind of play with it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that the audience is necessarily thinking this is a Western, but the structure is so ingrained in the, you know, the cultural understanding of film that those story arcs are, you know, they hit a place.
Yeah. I mean, were you a fan of Westerns? Is it?
Yeah. I mean, there came a time where I needed to sort of, you know, understand, you know, film intellectually. Mm. And, you know, Westerns are a huge part of that.
Mm.
And I believe, as you do, that a good many films are structurally Westerns.
Yeah.
And that the idea that the director is playing with is, you know, this guy comes into town to straighten things out or to make a mess.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, like, you know, I've watched some Westerns a lot.
Yeah.
You know, The Searchers and the standard ones, Shane and one Western that really strikes me, a modern Western, like I can watch The Unforgiven anytime because that to me, that just loaded it all in there and that character. But The Pale Rider, that's like a classic structure and it's awesome.
Mm.
You know, the guy with the shady past. You know, or Jeremiah Johnson. That's another one that I watched.
Mm.
That I don't know that I thought of as a Western, but it is. It's a very unique Western.
Yeah, Jude and I talked a lot about that lead character of a Western. That there's very little that you actually know, because in The Order there was not a huge amount of kind of subtext to that character. You didn't understand,
but you did understand the sort of beat up detective.
Absolutely.
And what that entails from movies.
Absolutely. And there's that lovely feeling of, is this character even going to make it through the film?
Yeah.
You know, that
sure.
they seem so kind of failed in a way.
Yeah.
And there's this lovely kind of rooting for them that you kind of realize, okay, if they've made it halfway through the film, then I guess they're going to make it to the end.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think's kind of wonderful about. And, you know, and it's, you know, something like The French Connection. You sort of look at that Gene Hackman character and really their character evolves within the scenes.
Sure.
You know, it's how that character responds to what is coming towards them in the present of the scenes rather than a whole lot of exposition. So I think those characters are written less now. I think there's this sort of feeling at the moment when you read screenplays of trying to kind of understand as much as possible about everything, including your lead character. Whereas I think when you go back and you watch those films, it's the mystery of that character that makes them so alluring.
less words are the better. Yeah, and once Popeye Doyle gets obsessed, then the game is on. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah,
doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah,
that the response to him shooting that Fed is just one of the best moments in movies.
Yeah, yeah,
where he sees him and then he just moves on.
Yeah.
Right, like, you know, Scheider is, you know, like, oh, God, what'd you do? And he's like, I got to find the French guy.
Yeah,
this guy had it coming. You know, I talked to Friedkin for hours. Mm. It was kind of crazy.
He's amazing.
Yeah, him and Michael Mann were just monsters of that the ability to have that kind of swagger with those movies and make the kind of impact that they did is kind of insane. Like I've watched Thief a few times again, but he's another guy not unlike you in a couple of the movies where the less said the better.
Yeah
because then it's on you the audience to kind of put
I just put the soundtrack actually
of Thief
just yesterday at Amoeba.
Tangerine Dream
it was there for about $6.
Yeah.
I grabbed it.
It's great.
Fantastic soundtrack.
Oh, it's the best.
Yeah.
Now the Kelly Gang, the true history of the Kelly Gang, which I didn't watch yet, but that's a story that's been told over and over again, right?
Mm.
Like hasn't every Australian filmmaker tried to tell that story?
Yeah, I don't know why that character or that person, Ned Kelly, has had probably 100 films made about them, and somehow is this sort of defining character that we all lean towards in terms of what our identity is or isn't.
What is it about the character? I don't know a lot about him. Is it like Jesse James here?
Yeah. I mean, he was this Irish kind of, this Irish bandit who robbed and created a rebellion in Victoria.
Yeah.
And, you know, became this, and became very famous because he created this sort of suit of armor. That was sort of, from the helmet all the way to, you know, and at the end of his life was sort of, was in this sort of Glen Rowan, this sort of house, and this massive siege happened, and he sort of came out all guns blaming, like this kind of monitor.
Yeah.
And it was sort of mythical and sort of legendary.
Sure.
And somehow has sort of become, I mean, even in our Olympics, even at the Sydney Olympics and the closing ceremony, there was a whole segment about this criminal, an outlaw. There's like 100 Ned Kellys like running around in,
really?
Yeah, in kind of armored suits. So,
yeah.
You know, and you can get Ned Kelly pies and there's Ned Kelly theme parks. It's a kind of fascination.
So the reality of the guy has been eclipsed by the mythology of the guy.
Yeah. And I was really interested in this. It's called The True History of the Kelly Gang, written by Peter Carey, amazing Australian writer. And the book is about, you know, well, what is the truth about this figure, and why as Australians do we somehow kind of need to search for meaning as to who.
Did you take him down a notch? I haven't seen the film.
Yeah, definitely. He's definitely. I mean, it's really interesting, the film. And Peter kind of they used to imitate the Sons of Sieve, which were this sort of Irish group that the Irish bandits kind of would dress in women's dresses to kind of terrorize the police and sort of make it look as if they were kind of mad. And that's what they thought was the greatest kind of weapon, was this perception of madness and sort of intimidate and scare the police away. So we've kind of got the gang, dressed in dresses throughout the whole film. And it was quite sort of
controversial.
Yeah, different.
Did you get any pushback?
Well, everyone claims this character for certain things. So yeah, there was some that sort of looked at it and kind of obviously had a certain opinion about it.
Yeah, yeah. Did you? You didn't piss off half the country?
Oh, I'm sure I pissed off a lot, but yeah.
Didn't Mick Jagger play Ned Kelly?
He did. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Dennis Hopper came and played Mad Dog Morgan, who was another kind of outlaw. There's a sort of fascination in Australian outlaws that you know, seems to grab people's imaginations, especially overseas.
Well, Irish outlaws are the most frightening.
Yeah.
Oddly, you know, yeah, you think it was the Italians, but anytime I see anything about Irish mob, I'm like, oh fuck.
Yeah, I mean that kind of, I mean, it's interesting how that's traveled through filmmaking.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, you know, in a sense, that sort of chopper figure that Andrew was playing with has a similar kind of...
Eric Bana's chopper?
Yeah, there's a kind of humor and a kind of outlaw kind of attraction
that
has similar kind of Ned Kelly vibes.
Sure. Oh, so that, I was thinking that must be some sort of continuation of the arc. There is a certain type of, I guess the Australian cowboy's a bit different. Than ours.
Yeah, they're not as romantic.
Yeah.
they're a little messier.
So, like, all right, but let's talk about the Nitram thing, because that guy who played the lead is some special guy.
Yeah, Caleb Landry-Jones, who's American.
I know. Yeah. I think I've had the opportunity to interview him, but I didn't take it. Maybe it'll happen again. I never know what anyone's going to be like, and I hadn't seen your movie yet. But Jesus, man, that performance was crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
How'd you get that out of him?
Well, he's just so immersive, Caleb. He kind of, I mean, he learned the Australian accent by, we had an amazing voice coach, but he watched hours and hours and hours of Australian soap, TV soap, Neighbours, and sort of this other soap called Home and Away. He watched hours of it from the 90s.
Yeah.
And just religiously. So he kind of, and he was sort of speaking with an Australian accent the whole time, which is a very hard accent to do, especially for Americans.
Yeah.
Although he's from Texas, so there's a kind of drawl and a kind of laziness that Australians have as well in their accent. We did that during COVID. He came over, was in a hotel for 2 weeks, and then he came to Geelong where we shot the film. And was in isolation there, so he really didn't see much of the rest of the country apart from being in the kind of bubble of this film.
Yeah,
but he's quite extraordinary. He's one of the most immersive actors I've been with. He really, you know, the point at which he sort of clocks off and clocks on is very blurred.
Yeah,
and he always sort of keeps something there of the character. It was pretty inspiring.
It's a relentless movie, dude. And that's your wife.
That's my wife who plays
Helen.
Yeah, plays Helen.
She was spectacular.
Yeah, yeah, she's wonderful.
I mean, that was whatever that was, her empathy or the romance of, you know, having that guy in her home was really, I'd never seen anything like it in a movie.
Yeah, it's a really interesting character. She was the heir to a Tats Lotto company. So she was
a what?
A Tats Lotto, like a gambling, like a lottery kind of company.
Okay. Yeah.
So she had an enormous amount of inheritance.
This is a true story,
money.
Right?
Yeah, enormous amount of money.
And she was eccentric.
Eccentric. She was in love with Gilbert and Sullivan and loved musicals and was sort of desperately sort of dressing up in various kind of costumes and, you know, and obviously terribly sort of lonely, but lived in this amazing mansion with much more dogs than we had in the film. So it was like 50 dogs and 20 cats. And she just took on, you know, accepted this boy who came over and mowed her lawn, and they sort of developed this very, very odd relationship and sort of promised to travel and go overseas.
And so, like, it's weird that turn in that movie, when I hadn't seen Judy Davis in a long time.
Mm, yeah.
And she's great.
Yeah,
she's always great. Yeah. And I didn't even realize Anthony LaPaglia was Australian.
Yeah.
I think I kind of knew that, but I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And he was great.
Yeah.
I mean, the acting in that movie, and it's telling that it was informed by COVID because nobody was doing anything.
Yeah.
So the vitality of a performance during COVID is, you know, that's your communication for the day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there is something so, like, in that movie where there's a turn of what should be heartbreak somewhere. it kind of gets hijacked by a certain type of mental illness. You know, that car accident is devastating.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that the character wasn't devastated, but I don't know how much it shifted from his regular disposition.
Yeah, well, I think he just became more and more isolated. There was a really interesting detail that happened after that crash where he was given the money.
In real life.
Yeah, and inherited this money.
And that happens in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he goes on these trips. So yeah. He used to do these trips where he'd buy first-class tickets to different cities all around the world.
Yeah.
And he'd get on and he would just look for companionship on the plane.
Yeah.
So he'd sit next to someone and just talk their head off for on a 23-hour flight to London.
Yeah.
Get to the airport, get off, go through customs, and then turn around and get on another one and come back. Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. It was this continual kind of revolving, taking first-class trips just to talk to people on aeroplanes.
And
that went on for like a year, 2 years. I mean, we've just got one instance there where he goes to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But it was this, there was this detail that I found kind of quite extraordinary.
Well, what did you key into that compelled you to make that movie? Do you get a script for that?
Yeah, Sean, who wrote Snowtown, Sean Grant sent me the script. And it's a, you know, look, it's a very, you know, I opened it and just went, there's no way I'm doing this. I live in this state.
Yeah.
And it's a very taboo kind of subject, very difficult subject to talk
in
about.
In Tasmania.
Yeah, in Australia.
Anywhere.
Yeah. That particular day was really devastating and changed the gun laws forever in Australia.
It
really shifted everything. But it's a, you know, really difficult kind of period to sort of talk about. So I was extremely nervous about it. But there was just a key into how someone, you know, becomes an outlier like that and becomes more and more separated. But most importantly, it was just this sort of family setup.
Yeah.
How a mother kind of starts to see someone that they've given birth to kind of slowly fade away and disappear and sort of desperately trying to reach them to bring them back. There was something about that family unit that I thought was, it was really compelling.
Yeah. The tolerance.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially the father, that that despite the fact that the kid was volatile, you know, there you want him to be all right.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's, and you adapt to them.
Yeah.
But there, after a certain point, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
To make them all right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just I'd never seen a movie like it. Really, how did that? What was the reaction to that movie?
At the time that we made it, there was a really strong reaction against it. I remember the Prime Minister talking about it in Parliament.
Really?
About this film should not be made. And I think people thought we were going to do a certain, I don't know, horror film or something about it. But
right.
But also that it was subject matter that should be left alone.
Yeah.
And then I think as people saw it and we finished it, they kind of, you know, could see the sort of angle and the way we were sort of gently kind of walking through the film that shifted.
That's interesting because nationally, I would imagine that there was no desire to have empathy for that guy.
Mm.
And, you know, because you, along with the writer, are careful to present as they are human, that there's no way in moments not to have empathy for that guy.
Mm. Mm. Well, yeah. And I think, there was something I think also about those small moments that change fate and destiny. Like it was sort of fascinating in the sort of moments leading up to the massacre of, there was one moment in the film where he stopped to sort of fix a car. There were a couple kind of tourists there that were, he actually asked whether, after he fixed the car, whether he could go with him on a bushwalk.
Right.
You know, and he was going on the way to Port Arthur. And,
yeah.
You know, and they said, no, we want to go sort of by ourselves.
Yeah.
And so he went on and then sort of, you know, went to a petrol station and then spoke to the guy at the petrol station, you know, do you want to go for a beer? And he sort of said, no. There was this sort of really like the fine line between, you know, what that fate was at the end to kind of him suddenly kind of going left and bushwalking. I found
if it would have changed anything?
I don't know. But it was, I remember that was a really tough thing to balance in the film of, you know, whether this was a sort of set destiny.
Yeah.
He decided this and this is what he was going to do, or whether it could be changed on a whim.
Right.
Whether there was some sort of little influence that would kind of just shift the tide a bit. But it was a real challenge to kind of try to find the right sort of feeling and tone for that.
Well, I don't know that I've seen, you know, many movies that really do that exploration of senseless mass shooting, you know, other than Gus Van Sant's Elephant. Which had the same space.
Mm.
But there was a sexual component to that.
Mm.
You know, this guy Martin, your guy, obviously had issues, you know, that could not be sated. But the turn from just a guy who was distressed mentally to a killer was—I thought he handled it very well. And there, you know, the moment where he pulls that gun out, and then, you know, we're out of the movie.
Mm.
You know, after we hear a few shots off camera,
we don't even hear shots.
You don't.
No, it cuts to it cuts then to the mother sitting having a cup of tea, and in the background is the news just breaking. Yeah, it was I think that's why there was a big uproar. I think they thought that we were going to recreate the full massacre, which was horrendous, absolutely horrific. But we always knew that we wanted to stop it just before that.
And did you ever hear from families or anything?
Yeah, look, there were families that were very upset about it being made, and you know, and they, you know, rightly so. There were others that we spoke to and sort of could understand why we were making it, but it was a tough time making.
Why were you making it?
I just reading this script, I just got an insight into that isolation, and there was something about that family that felt familiar. There was something about that mother and father that just felt, you know, this desperate need to try to love and, you know, try to bring that child back, and the desperation in them. There was something about that I really responded to.
It's hard to humanize monsters and have to shoulder that burden.
Yeah, and like you mentioned empathy before, and, you know, it's that is a real challenge. Like how, you know, even with Bob Matthews, it's kind of like how, you know, where do you place this?
Yeah.
You know, you've got to understand why he's so compelling. why he draws people in. At the same time, you don't want to make this guy sort of likable in a way that,
but you want to make him familiar.
You do. You do. Yeah. You want to go past the kind of cliche and really sort of try to unpack. Okay, well, what is it?
Yeah, you know? And ultimately, Jude Law's character doesn't really get to serve the justice.
Yeah.
That he probably would have preferred.
Yeah. No, he misses it, but it was something about that character that sort of foresaw the future a little bit. That somehow he was sort of looking into our eyes and understanding kind of what perhaps it would become, you know.
And what are your feelings about that? Where's the, well, first, like, what is the future of the movie in America here?
Well, it's out now. It's playing now. It's, people are seeing it.
Yeah.
It seems to be doing well. So there's, you know, and I was really curious as to what was going to happen after the election.
Yeah.
But there seems to be, you know, people seem to be interested in understanding.
Yeah,
an event too that I think is hardly known.
Yeah, you know, interesting,
which is
right?
Kind of shocking. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I became sort of obsessed with that whole the Turner Diaries and the root of that.
Did you know much about the Turner Diaries before
the
film?
Yeah. I don't know. There was like I became sort of fascinated with that stuff around the time of when I was sort of learning about Berg and then learning that this book was driving a lot of the anti-Semitic sentiment. You know, I became sort of curious about, you know, where the idea of Zog came from and why, you know, and then as you sort of get more into it, and certainly now that these are reinterpretations, if not direct interpretations of ancient anti-Semitic tropes.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that the Zionist-occupied government was essentially from Turner, wasn't it? From the Turner Diaries.
Yeah.
I mean, that was sort of a revamping of a global anti— that was the creation of the global anti-Semitic, the global Jew-run planet.
Mm.
I think that started with that.
Mm. Well, yeah, the whole book is sort of the fear of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's—
Yeah, and those are relatively modern anti-Semitic tropes that have really taken hold. But, you know, blood libel and all that stuff, that goes back to what, the Middle Ages.
Mm.
So, and that's in Shakespeare.
Mm.
But that was really the beginning of, you know, whatever George Soros represents to these people.
Mm. Mm.
It's scary stuff now.
Yeah.
So are you doing a Hitler movie next? What's Wait, is there like you can do a kind of a thoughtful Manson piece?
No, it's— I'll tell one that I'm really interested in doing is this film called Burning Rainbow Farm, which is based on two guys that created the Burning Rainbow Marijuana Festival. And it was—
Where's that?
It's down south somewhere, and it was in the late 90s, and these two guys are a couple, and they had this kid that they were sort of bringing up. Anyway, they were sort of trying to be run out of town. Two men.
Yeah.
And their kid was sort of taken away from them, I think after a raid on their farm. But the festival became quite large. There were like 50,000 people turning up in the 90s to smoke dope and listen to Willie Nelson. And anyway, their kid was taken away, and they sort of burnt down the farm, and this siege happened over 2 weeks to sort of get recognition that their kid had been taken away.
Yeah.
And and they were killed in this siege. It's extraordinary story. This beautiful kind of love story between these two guys.
Yeah.
But also this amazing kind of event that happened like a week before September 11. So it didn't really sort of—
Yeah, I didn't know anything about
it. Yeah. So I'm hoping to make that.
Is it happening?
I think so. Sebastian's doing it. Sebastian Stan is going to play one of the characters I know you had on.
Yeah, he's great. Recently. Yeah, he's
fantastic. That's sort of again based on a true story, and you know I seem to be interested in these certain kind of outliers.
Yeah, but, and that's a good— that seems like a good one. Good arc.
Yeah.
Well, you look healthy during the shooting. I don't know how far along I was there, but man, you looked tired, wired, smoking two cigarettes at a time.
Yeah.
I was like, is this guy going to make it through this shoot?
Yeah. No, I made it. I got there, mate.
It was pretty intense, man.
I was worried I wouldn't even make it through that night where we—
We did the shooting. Driving around in that VW.
I was worried about— worried about you catching a plane in the morning, but I was also worried about you wearing old school
squibs.
Yeah,
and we only had two jackets.
Yeah,
we only had two shots at it.
Yeah, but you were an absolute trooper, and we had to kind of get it. You know, pretty quickly, and the camera was on the camera. It's quite a particular shot.
Oh, that's right. We were up against the clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looked good, man.
It did it.
Disturbing.
It's got a feel about it that we aim for. It was great.
Yeah. Sticky stuff, that stuff.
The blood.
Yeah. But it worked.
But you were amazing.
I appreciate that. You too,
really,
man.
Really love you being in the film. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Yeah, and I've loved watching your other work. I'm going to continue to do it. Good talking to you, man.
Okay, mate.
Love that guy. That was a great talk. I enjoy— I there's something about Australia, man. It's heavy. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm glad we talked about it. I haven't been down there in a while, but there's a weight to it. The Order, again, is playing in theaters now. Hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, people. Another Mark and Tom show is now available for full Marin subscribers. This was the third time I sat down with Tom to talk about the stuff that me and Tom are always thinking about.
Especially for an athlete, that's the hard thing. It's like you and me and people working in a medium that does not require physical talent. You can get better as you get into your 40s and even 50s or beyond.
I felt like I should jump up and start doing squats as we talk. there was something that in my mind, I'm like, what are you talking about, Tom?
Yeah, I can still
look,
do
I'm
it.
Moving.
I still got it. Yeah. But it's like, if you're an athlete,
yeah,
it's like people talk about you being like, oh, this, like, because I watch basketball a lot, and they'll be like, I'll be watching, be like, look at that old guy out there. And I realize, it's like, oh, that guy's 8 years younger than me. Like, who's this guy think he is? This old man hobbling his way out on the floor, 8 years younger than me.
Why did they even let him play?
Yeah. It's just, but it's like, he's an old man. Could you imagine being, like, unable to do the thing that was your identity? You know, it's over for you at like 35, maybe.
That's available now if you're signed up for the full Marin. To subscribe, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder, before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some classic Marin riffage. Monkey lives. La Fonda! Cat angels everywhere. Okay.